Call to order this meeting of the House Commerce Committee. Our first order, we do have a quorum. Our first order of business is approval of our minutes from February 15th of 2023. Representative Katisa Watoon, do you have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move approval of the February 15th minutes.
Representative Katisa Watoon moves approval of the minutes from February 15th, 2023. Discussion to the motion. Seeing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and the minutes for February 15th of 2023 are approved. We have four bills on the agenda today. First is House File 1520 from Representative Hemmingson-Yeager. As you come down, I will move House File 1520 be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. And Representative Hemmingson-Yeager, you have an author's amendment, the A1 amendment, which perhaps we can adopt first before going to your opening remarks. The A1 amendment being an author's amendment, I will make the motion for the A1 amendment. Any discussion to the motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails and A1 is adopted. Representative Hemmingson-Yeager, to your bill.
Great. Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair and members. My name is Amanda Hemmingson-Yeager, new representative, but I am also trained and experienced as a geneticist. So very excited. I have a master's in genetics. Very honored and excited to kind of be offering this bill, which is about direct-to-consumer genetic testing. If anybody wants to light reading later, I also did my own paper on it at the Humphreys. So very well-versed in this type of information. Overall about the bill, I want to be concise and succinct, being a scientist. It's a very collaborative project. I've been working with people from the industry, people with health privacy rights activists, both DFLers and GOPers. It's bipartisan. And basically, we all know that genetic testing is becoming increasingly more powerful, and it's becoming increasingly more in use. This specifically focuses on the direct-to-consumer genetic testing. So these are things where you get a kit, you can spit into a tube, you can send it back to the company, and they can do a whole host of things that their company advertises, from finding ancestors to finding your evolutionary roots to your potential increase in health risks. Basically, this bill overall, and I kind of have my testifiers expand more on it, but in a nutshell, it lays out the expectations that a consumer can have for their privacy when it comes to genetic identity. And it also lays out expectations from the direct-to-consumer genetic testing company itself. So again, I'm very well aware of what we're doing with this type of technology. If you lose your license, you lose your Social Security card, you can get those back. You lose your genetic information, that is you. You can't really get a replacement genetic genome. So with that, I can have the testifiers come down.
Great. We do have several people who signed up to testify. Excuse me. The first is Richie Engelhart. Come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you. My name is Richie Engelhart. I'm the head of government affairs at Ancestry, and I'm here today on behalf of the Coalition for Genetic Data Protection in strong support of HF 1520. Ancestry is proud of the work that we have done with our coalition partners, including 23andMe, to implement common sense privacy protections that ensure all consumers are in control of their genetic data at all times. Together with privacy advocates and the Future Privacy Forum, a leading nonprofit that focuses on privacy thought leadership, we developed what we believe are the appropriate guidelines for direct-to-consumer genetic testing services. This includes ensuring consumers provide separate express consents, meaning we cannot bury the consents in our terms of service or privacy policies for any collection, processing, or sharing of their genetic data. The bill would require separate express consent for all of the following: analyzing the consumer's biological sample, storing the consumer's biological sample after it's been analyzed for future testing, and I'll note that's completely optional. If the consumer does not want their sample banked, they can still participate in the company's services. Viewing genetic relatives on our websites, and both parties have to consent to that or that match is not revealed, so it's actually a double opt-in. Using a consumer's genetic data for marketing purposes, and I'll note neither Ancestry nor 23andMe do this. It doesn't pass the creepiness test. But if there is a company out there that wants to use genetic information for targeted marketing purposes, this bill would require them to get a separate express consent for that. And for research, if a consumer opts in for research, they actually get kicked into an informed consent process. And that informed consent explains the benefits and the risks of research. And this is the same as any clinical trial that's conducted in the U.S. It's governed by an institutional review board. All of the common rule provisions would apply to that research. And then sharing their data with any third party for any reason. So aside from the consents we must collect from consumers, they're empowered to delete their data at any time and have a biological sample that they previously opted to have stored destroyed. They can end their relationship with our companies and have their data and samples deleted, and we retain no rights to it whatsoever. This bill puts these protections into law, outlining our responsibilities to Minnesota consumers and clearly explaining their rights when they engage with direct-to-consumer genetic testing services to learn more about their genealogy or health. This approach has broad bipartisan and stakeholder support. Since 2021, six states have enacted similar laws, including Arizona, California, Kentucky, Maryland, Utah, and Wyoming. And aside from Minnesota, 10 other states have similar measures in progress this year, Virginia being the furthest along. And while Ancestry and 23andMe have adhered to these practices the entire time that we've offered DTC genetic testing products, this bill will ensure that every direct-to-consumer testing service is held to the same standards for data protection and privacy. Our consumers' trust is our top priority. If they don't trust that we are employing strong privacy standards for their genetic data, they simply won't use our service. So we urge a favorable report on the bill, and I welcome any questions the committee may have.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Rich Neumeister. Mr. Neumeister, come forward, state your name for the record, proceed your testimony.
Would it be possible if someone could pass these out?
Yeah, I think we have a committee pages can do that, sir, for you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Rich Neumeister. I'm going to be speaking with you about four basic things about this bill. Now, this bill came in as a model bill. And so what's happening is folks are trying to improve privacy and consent provisions from a Minnesota perspective, like other states have done. Number one issue is enforcement. Your committee won't be handling it, but it's important for you to know that there's talk about a right to private action. We, in our law, 13.386, have a genetic privacy law that deals with almost everybody. But it's in the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. And so on the Senate side, and with the amendment you're adopting here, it refers to that. That's still a thing in discussion, how to do that right a private action or something like that as it heads to the other committee. Secondly, definitely this is under your jurisdiction, 45027, if you see on the last page, is the enforcement provision with the Department of Commerce. I have some concerns about that. One is that in other states that have had this kind of enforcement, if the complainant is found in their favor, they get part of the fine or whatever it is. So I would like to suggest that if the Department of Commerce takes someone and then there's a amount of money that they get, rather than go to the general fund to give the person whole, that should go to them. The fourth point, and to me a very important point, is if you look at the bill on lines page 3, 14 through 17, you'll see general consent provisions. And with the handout that I shared with you, you'll see two references to California and also Virginia, which is right now on the verge of passing similar legislation. And you'll see at the bottom language that I'm suggesting be changed from the written language, which is on top of the line page. The way the consent provision is now is just a very general kind of provision. You will, what California and Virginia and that what I think we should have in Minnesota with their most private of all data, our DNA, we should be able to approve of use every time it's outside of going to third parties. We use each use. Number two, we should have the name of who that individual of that party is. And so that is one area that I know, Mr. Chairman, that the chair, who's been great to work with, is still entertaining as this bill goes fast. I think it's just important, my last statement, in any of these, it's an issue, is consent or the individual on this most part of ourselves should be freely given, specific, informed, and unambiguous. Parts of this bill, and particularly the one that of the consent that I just shared with you, which I have a problem with, is opposite of that. It's ambiguous, does really give no knowledge for the individual, and it's broad consent. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I thank you very much for the few moments of your time.
Thank you, sir. Next, we have Natasha Chernyavsky. Come forward, state your name for the record. Proceed to your testimony.
Hello, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Natasha Chernyavsky. I'm the Legislative and Policy Specialist for Citizens Council for Health Freedom. CCHF has long supported genetic privacy rights, and today we are very thankful for this conversation taking place and for Representative Hemmingson-Yeager's work. On this bill, we've had multiple conversations both with her and on the Senate side with Senator Klein about our concerns for this bill, and that namely that this bill doesn't specifically give protections for a few areas of genetic privacy, and we are concerned that it would give consumers a false sense of security. As I mentioned, we testified on this bill on the Senate side, and we are very thankful for the amendments that were adopted there and then also brought forward here. However, we are still deeply concerned with line 2.25 of the bill, which states genetic data does not include de-identified data. The bill's intent is to give consumers protection over their genetic data. However, line 2.25, under it as it stands, the companies will only be obligated to protect a subset of consumer genetic data. Anything that is de-identified may be shared without consumer consent. Those specimens and any related data will be exempt from the protective provisions of this bill. What is even more concerning then is when we realize that, as noted by 23andMe, if this data, this de-identified data is breached at any point in time, it can be re-identified using a public database. So there's really a huge lack of security and potential privacy for the consumer. As Representative Hemmingson-Yeager mentioned in her opening remarks, once you lose your genetic privacy, you can't get that back. And so we are deeply concerned at the potential for that to happen. And the lack of consent requirements over de-identification and the lack of protections offered in this bill over de-identified data. Our second concern is on lines 3.20 and 3.21, which states that Minnesota policy regarding consent for research is to be defined by the federal common rule for federally funded research. Thus, this bill would transfer authority to federal officials to determine the definition and even the need for obtaining consent for any potential research or data sharing. The common rule provides four reasons that consent requirements can be waived, including whenever an IRB decides that there's minimum risk to the individual. That should be an individual's decision, not a corporate IRB decision. Minnesota should not cede authority to an unelected federal official who could change consent provisions with every new administration or in line with industry lobbying. Finally, if this committee intends to pass the bill, we have two more suggestions to strengthen consumer protections in addition to our request that lines 2.25 would be deleted, and also the request that that reference to the common rule would be taken out, both of the bill and now of the added amendment. First, a require informed consent specific to de-identification of the specimen. The consumer should be informed that they lose all rights to where it goes and what happens once it's de-identified, and that they have the choice as to whether it's de-identified and used in the first place. Second, on line 4.4, give consumers access to all accounting of disclosures so they know with whom and how often their information is being shared. Again, thank you so much for the opportunity to testify, for your concern and interest in this bill. We do believe that it's important to protect genetic privacy, and these are just our suggestions to make this bill something that does protect consumers, that is a strength to their privacy all the way through, and there's not a subset of their DNA left unprotected. Thank you again for the chance to speak today.
Thank you. That concludes all of the people who signed up to testify. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify to this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion and questions. Members, to the bill. Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, before questions, just a little bit of background. Where is this getting referred to from here?
To judiciary.
And how many more committee stops does it have?
I believe that probably is it. I think that's probably the only one.
Okay. That's good for background. I'll wait until others have had a chance to ask questions before I'm sure my thoughts. Thank you, Mr.
Sounds
Chair.
Good. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager. My first question, I wanted to start with what Ms. Chernyavsky was talking about with the federal common rule on page 3, line 20 and 21. And maybe you know the answer to this, or maybe a researcher can help us. If we deleted the reference to the common rule and just said informed consent is required, what would be the meaning of that under Minnesota law, if you know, or if someone...
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager, if you can answer, otherwise we can ask nonpartisan staff if they can help.
Yeah, I'm going to refer to nonpartisan staff if that's okay.
I don't know. Is that? I don't think we have an answer to that question.
Okay.
Right in front of us, Representative Niska. Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
That being the case, I will give my understanding of this. Sure. So this particular common rule does regard like human resource subjects. So my only concern then would be. Having state law conflicting with federal law when it comes to that specific type of person.
And in Representative Niska, since you're on the Judiciary Committee, perhaps you can follow up with nonpartisan staff and they can get you an answer before you see the bill again.
Perhaps we could.
President Niska.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. My next question, I guess, is something that was raised by Representative Neumeister about, or by Mr. Neumeister about.
Sometimes it feels that way.
So, exactly. About the remedies here, and he referenced potentially the Commerce Department giving something to individuals who are injured. And my understanding of the way this would work is it would essentially create some part of the contract between the company and the individual, and they would most likely have some sort of breach of contract remedy, as well as whatever Commerce Department remedy this is creating. Is that the intent of this bill? Is that it's going to kind of supplement the contractual obligations between a consumer and an individual company, so that the consumer would at least have also a breach of contract claim against the company if they break the law?
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
If you're asking what I think you're asking, no, this is not meant to supplement any sort of contract between the consumer and the company. The part about Mr. Neumeister's suggestions are still being worked on. I'm working with Representative Scott to figure out exactly how we can do this the best way possible to make sure that consumers are protected, but also my experience working in a lab, understanding what happens in a lab with these biological samples. So if that answers your question or not.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hemmingson-Yeager. I'm not sure it does, and I think this actually is good for the bill. That their terms of service, whenever a customer clicks on the terms of service, they have to agree that they're complying with all applicable laws, and I think this just actually beefs up the terms of service if they don't already contain all of these protections in the contract between the customer and a Minnesota customer and a company. I think this bill is going to sort of raise the standards that they have to meet in their contract with them. So that's all I was trying to get at. Does that make more sense? Does that clarify my question? Maybe that.
We'll see.
All good? Representative Niska?
Yeah, that's all for now.
Okay. Representative Cleburne. Oh, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Yeah, may I respond really quick?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Okay, so perhaps Mr. Engelhardt, if he's still here. Okay, he could probably speak better to the actual company itself. My understanding is that under 45.027, that does give Commerce some sort of civil investigatory process. So that's kind of where we would see that housed on the state side.
Mr. Engelhardt, did you have something you wanted to add to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Yes. So our privacy policy is a part of our terms of service, so you're absolutely correct. If we were to violate our privacy policy in any way, it would be a violation of the terms of service. Standard tort law would apply.
Representative Niska, anything to follow up there?
No, Representative Stevens, Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. That's exactly what I was hoping the answer was, that there is still some way that an individual who has been injured has some legal remedies that this is bolstering, as well as the commerce enforcement power. So thanks.
Great. Representative Cleburne.
I'm sorry, I have to turn my back to you. I want to say thank you for bringing the bill forward, and I appreciate the comments that we heard from both of the other two testifiers. You know, privacy is something that's very near and dear and important to me, and so at least in bringing this bill forward, are you then just letting the general public know that there are concerns with privacy currently in the direct-to-consumer market? And by making this would be an I guess I'm asking for clarification. This says to the consumer, you need to opt out or these protections will be in place. Is that correct?
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
So my intention with this bill is, you know, coming from a space where it's very complex, very fast-moving information, such as genetics. Like I said, it's a very increasingly powerful tool. You know, I can go back and see, you know, my increased risk for heart disease or where my ancestors came from. But making sure that the public understands what they're getting into. So by each of these, it's laid out in the bill. But by prompting the consumer to go through a series of screens and say, this is what this means to be going into research. Yes, I accept or no, I do not. This is what this means to say, I am giving you my biological sample. Yes or no. I would like you to store my biological sample. Yes or no. So that they understand kind of each step of the process so that there's no surprises.
Okay. So Representative
Cleaborn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's kind of an educational vehicle for the consumer as well as a protection for the consumer. Is that correct?
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Yeah, I think so.
Representative Cleaborn.
Thank you very much, Chair. I have no further statements or questions.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very briefly, everyone wants their data protected, whether it's in genetics or their credit card or whatever the case may be. And we always hear about different breaches of things that occur. I have concerns today about where we are at in this bill, and that's why I asked about where we're going with the Judiciary Committee. I am hoping that we can continue to work to get some of these other open and unresolved questions resolved, some of the things that Mr. Neumeister brought up. He has been here for quite a long time and has been quite the advocate for data privacy and things here at the legislature, and probably will be here long after many of us are gone as well. He's just that dedicated to the mission. As a matter of fact, I heard his contract with himself is that he will stop being down here 2 years after the time he has passed away from this earth. So he plans on being here for quite a long period of time. So, Mr. Chair, unfortunately today I have to be a no vote because I don't think it's in a shape that makes sense for us to move it. But again, knowing that I can always change that vote should I see a version of the bill that I like when it makes it to the Minnesota House floor. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hemmingson-Yeager, I'll give you the final word.
Thank you so much for the discussion and for the questions. I'm here if you have any more questions. Representative O'Driscoll, if you want to meet, be happy to talk a little bit more and hash some things out. It can be really complicated when you start really like diving into the nuts and bolts, but that's why I'm here. So we appreciate your support and thank you.
All right. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 1520, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and House File 1520, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Thank you, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager. The next item on our agenda will be House File 156 from Representative Feist. And as Representative Feist comes forward, I will move House File 156 be recommended to be placed on the general register. And I will also move the DE2 amendment, an author's amendment from Representative Feist. Representative Feist, if you want to briefly tell the committee about your DE2 amendment before we pick it up.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair. This just reflects some updated agreements between the park owners and the residents and gets the bill into the shape that I would like.
Any discussion to the DE2 author's amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails and the DE2 amendment is adopted. I understand there's an oral amendment, so perhaps before we get to the discussion of the bill, we can just get that out of the way. Representative O'Driscoll, did you want to make your motion there?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been brought to my attention that there is an extra word in the DE2 amendment that was just adopted. If members turn to page 3, line number 6, 3.6, it says in part in that sentence, electricians or licensed manufactured home park installers. The word park should be deleted to be able to be consistent with the language in reference to other parts in the DE amendment for that same group or classification of individuals. So it's an oral amendment striking the word park from line 3.6.
Representative O'Driscoll is moving to strike the word park from line 3.6 of the DE2 amendment. Representative Feist, any comments to that motion?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Driscoll, for noting this typo and bringing this oral amendment, and I would encourage members of the committee to support this.
Discussion to the oral amendment. Seeing no discussion, Mr. Eliff, could you please just state for the record the oral amendment that members will be voting on?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Page 3, line 6, delete the word park.
That is the motion on the table. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the oral amendment is adopted. Representative Feist, to your bill.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee. First, I would like to thank the Minnesota Manufacturing and Modular Home Association and Haven Park Communities for working collaboratively with us to arrive at this agreement that is reflected in the DE before you. This bill solves two festering problems. First, it clarifies the intent of the law that utility charges to residents are mere pass-throughs, and owners collect no more from residents than they are billed by utilities. The way the law is currently written and has been interpreted by courts, owners can and some do charge residents more than they owe to the public utility, the Cooperative Electric Association, or the City Water Company. Second, the bill resolves another ongoing issue by clarifying that park owners are permitted to install water meters to ensure that residents each pay for the water that they use and conservation is encouraged. And to ensure fairness, if water is already included in the rent, if the park owner wants to install metering, the residents' rent will be frozen for 13 months to ensure that the resident is not paying twice for water usage. So glad that everyone could come together on this common sense update to the law to ensure that utility charges are uniformly passed on to residents of manufactured housing communities in an appropriate way. Thank you.
All right. We do have two people who signed up to testify. The first is Ron Elwood. Mr. Elwood, state your name for the record. Proceed to your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and I just want to thank also the MMHA and Haven Park communities for working so closely with Legal Aid to address these two problems, and happy to answer any questions about the bill if you have them. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We also have Mark Brunner from Minnesota Manufactured Modular Home Associations. Mr. Brunner, if you come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark Brunner, Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota. We appreciate Representative Feist bringing the bill and being able to work with Legal Aid and Ron Elwood and coming to agreement on how a manufactured home communities can install water submetering, and sort of the core of the bill just addresses what's considered a substantial modification of a lease agreement. Just a brief history. I think it was in 2002 there was a Supreme Court decision that said if the manufactured home park community owner subsequently installs submetering devices when previously water had been included in the lease agreement, that would be a substantial modification. Therefore, you can't do it. And so what the bill does is puts in place a mechanism so that if someone wishes to submeter for conservation reasons, more fairness in water usage, we can now do that by following the prescription in the bill. And I appreciate the amendment and clarification on the manufactured home installer, and also like to thank the League of Cities and working with them on the conservation rate being applicable. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. That is the end of the list of people who signed up to testify. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion and questions. Discussion to the bill. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Feist, this is the way business should be done. You worked with the parties outside of the light of the legislature. You found agreement between Mr. Elwood and the group that he represents and Mr. Bruner and the group he represents, and you have made it very easy for us to be able to review and to support this. Isn't always the case when we see bills that come before the legislature, but I want to call out your work on this and thank you for doing it this way, because it does make it easier when the legislature does not have to pick winners and losers, when both parties are at the table liking a little bit of it, maybe not liking a little bit of what's going on. But that's called give and take, and that's negotiations. Again, thank you.
I'll give Representative Feist the last word. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Driscoll, for the kind words. This is the way I like to do things, and I really appreciate everyone's coming to the table, having these important discussions, coming up with these updates that I think will create a much better situation in Minnesota. So would encourage folks to support this bill.
Wonderful. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 156, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 156, as amended, is recommended to be placed on the general register. Thank you, Representative Feist.
Thank you.
The next bill on our agenda today is House File 1790 from our own Representative Liebling. Representative Liebling, would you like to move your bill?
I would, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1790 to be recommended to be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee, and I do have a DE1 amendment I would like to move.
All right. Representative Liebling moves House File 1790 be recommended to be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee, and also moves the DE1 amendment, which is an author's amendment, I take it, to get the bill in the shape you'd like us to consider. Is
correct.
That correct? Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails and the DE1 amendment is adopted. Representative Liebling, to your bill.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee, for giving me a quick hearing on this bill. So, and I just want to say that the DE1 reflects technical assistance from the Department of Commerce. So I have appreciated that assistance. So, members, we don't often talk about insurance that relates to Medicare. We talk about Medicaid a lot, but Medicare, as we all know, is federal insurance, and we don't have a lot of control over that. So I was quite surprised to learn that there is a category of Medicare-related insurance that we, in fact, do have regulatory control over, and that is the Medigap policy. So many people who are on Medicare will buy a Medigap policy, which is supplemental insurance that pays for the expenses that Medicare does not pay for. And these can be a lot. And this is a popular kind of insurance for folks to buy. I also did not know that there's quite a bit of variation among states on these plans. So Minnesota, in fact, doesn't seem to be really leading when it comes to giving consumers a really good deal on these Medigap insurance policies. So we know that under the Affordable Care Act, now we think about insurance as not having underwriting. In other words, when you go on MinSure, for example, you can buy an insurance plan without regard to whether you have pre-existing conditions. Everybody pays the same price for that insurance, without regard to whether you come in with some kind of you've had a heart attack or cancer or something like that. And we've all gotten kind of used to that. But in this Medigap area, in fact, that is not the case. There is still underwriting in Minnesota for these policies. So right now, there is a special enrollment period, you could call it, when you first go on Medicare, where you can buy a Medigap policy if you wish, and the insurer cannot use medical underwriting to deny the issuance of that plan. However, if you've been treated for or diagnosed for a condition within 90 days of signing up, you can be denied coverage for that condition. So this can continue to impact people. And insurers, in fact, can refuse to sell a policy outside of the open enrollment period based on medical underwriting, and they can also charge more for that policy. So this is a significant disadvantage to older Minnesotans. You don't have to be 65 to be on Medicare, but most folks are 65 and older who are on Medicare. So your constituents are, many of them are being impacted by this. So what the bill does is it removes the ability to do underwriting, which is, as I say, some other states do it differently, and some other states, in fact, don't allow the underwriting. It also establishes an annual open enrollment period in addition to the special enrollment periods that are already in law. So sometimes we think about we don't want to let people with whatever whatever health condition just buy insurance anytime, because you could analogize this to insuring a burning house. You don't let people go out and buy fire insurance when their house is burning. That's the function of open enrollment periods, to kind of control, you know, make people think ahead and not wait until they're sick in order to buy a policy. And so that's what this bill does. It removes the underwriting, and it establishes an annual open enrollment, which would be the same as for other Medicare policies, which I think would make it a lot clearer for Minnesotans who are on Medicare, because there's that period of time when everybody starts to get the advertisements and the TV is full of admonitions to sign up and not forget and so on. And at that time, they would also be able to buy a Medigap policy without underwriting under this bill. So I will stop there. I think the Department of Commerce was here to help me answer questions, if there are any. And so I appreciate your consideration.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. We do have one testifier who signed up to testify, Dana Bacon. Come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony, and welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Stevenson and members. My name's Dana Bacon. I'm here on behalf of the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. I'd like to support House File 1790. I mean, as we've heard discussed, I mean, most Americans usually enroll in Medicare when they reach age 65. And if you're on Medicare Part A or Part B, you're going to face some pretty high out-of-pocket costs if you get sick, because there's no annual spending limit on those costs for major medical coverage. I mean, to reduce those costs, we have the policies Representative Liebling described, Medigap. And this coverage can be critical for blood cancer patients. And cancer treatment's expensive. We all know this. I mean, if you don't have a Medigap plan for your Medicare and you get a cancer diagnosis, you could be facing thousands, even tens of thousands of dollars in out-of-pocket medical expenses. And as we've heard described, unfortunately, the only time a Medigap plan is available in Minnesota guaranteed is that six-month period when you're enrolling, when you turn 65 typically. Outside of that, there are no protections for medical underwriting. Organizations like mine have done tons of work with folks like you over the years to eliminate the discrimination that comes with pre-existing conditions, and we see Representative Liebling's bill as a great step to fight this type of discrimination. We don't want to see folks denied Medigap coverage. We don't want to see people charged higher premiums because of medical conditions they didn't choose to have. So this bill would keep plans from discriminating based on medical history, giving consumers better coverage options. Open enrollment is another really important step to help people make sure they get coverage they need when they need it. Thank you, Rep. Liebling, for bringing this bill forward. I hope you'll vote for it today. I do have one question for the bill author, but I'll just take it over here.
Sounds good. Thank you, Mr. Bacon. That was the only person who signed up to testify. Is there any member of the public wishing to testify to the bill? Seeing none, we will move to member discussion and questions to the bill. Discussion to the bill. Representative Newbrindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Liebling. I am very aware of Medigap policies. Strangely, ALS is one of very few illnesses for which there's no denial with Medicare. So if you have a diagnosis of ALS, you are automatically qualified. And so when my late husband was diagnosed with ALS, we went ahead, obviously, as soon as he was approved for disability, which happened immediately, he went on Medicare, and we purchased one of these Medigap policies. We immediately purchased a supplemental policy, and we did that, obviously, with a pre-existing condition, knowing that with ALS, the cost of his care would be very high. We knew that with that pre-existing condition, it would be very, very expensive, and the out-of-pocket cost would have been very high for us. So I certainly am aware and understand the importance of the policy. My question is, and I appreciate what you said, that we want folks to think ahead and not wait until they are sick to get insurance. My concern with these changes is that from everything I've read, and I've, you know, it's kind of hard to find things, but I found a couple of different sources, one being AARP. It appears that, I had not seen this 90-day rule. I haven't read that anywhere, and so I would appreciate if you can help me or direct me to a source for that. But it seems that in this six-month period, as soon as somebody qualifies for Medicare or chooses Medicare, that they already have this period of time in which they cannot be denied for pre-existing conditions. And that would be the period in which, to your point, people are choosing coverage and not waiting until they get sick. Because that's what we don't want. We don't want people to wait and get sick. And as I look at that and as I think about that enrollment period, it makes sense to me that we would want people to sign up for that Medigap coverage, to sign up for those supplemental policies during that period, where then we are spreading the costs of potential care over an extended period of time, as opposed to waiting and not paying for that coverage for years and years and years until there is a diagnosis. And now there's a diagnosis, now it's going to get expensive, so now I'm going to buy the policy. Whereas it seems that the intent is very purposeful in that we want to spread those costs over many years, as opposed to concentrating those costs on that perhaps short period of time where someone is very ill and their care costs significantly more. It appears to me that this language, that this new provision would then actually eliminate that incentive to think ahead and not wait until they are sick to get coverage. That this eliminates that incentive. Am I understanding that correctly?
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative New Brindley, I'm not entirely sure that I'm following your line of reasoning here. Having annual open enrollment is a thing that people have in Medicare generally for other types of plans. Your drug coverage, you get to pick a new plan every year, should you choose to, should there be a change in prices, change in what drugs are available under certain plans, people can do this. So it's a common thing. If I'm understanding your question, you're wanting to limit people to only to that first open enrollment in order to sort of force them to pick and pick forever. That's how I'm understanding your question. And you know, I think people should be able to change plans if they need to change plans, if they find one that's better. Or sometimes people move and the old plan doesn't cover where they live anymore. Sometimes they're on Medicare Advantage and they want to go off Medicare Advantage. And we do have, it is a little bit complicated. There are some special enrollment periods in Minnesota law that would still be there for some of these things. But I think it's entirely reasonable to allow people to choose a plan once a year, and I don't think that sets up any sort of incentive to wait until you're sick, because you might find out you're sick and then have to wait 6 months to buy a plan. That's not going to help you. So having open enrollment, I mean, maybe Commerce could speak to this, but that seems to be a well-used strategy to that strikes a good balance between allowing consumers choice and the opportunity to change plans should they want to, and also stops this possible phenomenon of getting fire insurance when your house is on fire.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that's my concern. I think it is getting fire insurance when your house is on fire. Right now, under federal law, folks are guaranteed the right to this supplemental insurance. But they have to buy it before their house is on fire. They have to buy it before they are in that situation. This will allow them to buy the insurance when their house is on fire.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Brindley. Well, I guess you could say that about your experience. I mean, sometimes people are already have an illness when they turn 65. So, I mean, you know, I guess you could say that in your situation, you bought the insurance when the house was already on fire. I mean, I don't really see that, you know, there's nothing magical about that period of time. So when they're first going on to Medicare. So I don't know. I mean, this is not an uncommon thing to have open enrollment. I mean, people can pick a new drug plan. People can, you know, pick a new Medicare Advantage plan. You see all the ads for that all the time. I don't see why they shouldn't be able to pick a new Medigap plan if they should choose to during open enrollment or buy one for the first time.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you. And I think that that's the key, or buy one for the first time. And it is true. But right now, everyone is guaranteed the ability to buy this plan at 65. They've got their 6 months. So everyone is already guaranteed a supplemental plan, even if they have pre-existing conditions. But what you just said at the end there is to buy one for the first time. That's what we're saying, that this allows people to buy their fire insurance when their house is on fire. And I think that that is problematic. I think the point of insurance, the point of having insurance at all for any of us for any reason, whether it is healthcare coverage or, to your example, of fire insurance, is to spread the risks across a period of time, across a population, et cetera, to manage the costs and risks for all of us. And by doing this, my concern is that it's going to significantly increase the costs of those plans when we can access them at the time when the cost of care is most expensive, rather than spreading out those costs over the lifetime of a Medicare plan. I just think that there is some concern with the provision. I certainly think that these supplemental plans are incredibly important, and I would encourage everyone to invest in one, frankly, because Medicare does have gaps. There's cost sharing with Medicare, and with these supplemental plans, you can put yourself in a position where those cost sharing measures are covered. I think it is incredibly important, and I would encourage everyone to buy one, but I would encourage everyone to buy one when it becomes available, because that is how insurance works. That is how we distribute costs over a larger group of people, over a larger group of time, to maintain lower rates for everyone across the board. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion? Representative Cleaborn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm getting an education today. I didn't know that at 63, I was eligible to buy a GAP plan, and I'm a legislator, so it's interesting to me to learn that. I want to say, in human nature, we tend to accentuate the positives and try to ignore or pretend the negatives don't exist. I think it's reasonable that most of us anticipate that we will be healthy, that we will continue to have the lives that we have until we have some diagnosis that catches us off guard. The bill, I think, is important to have an annual enrollment period for people to make the changes that they need to make. They may choose a plan even early, thinking that that's the right plan, and then discover that isn't the right plan for them. So I just want to say that I think this is a really important bill for people to have the access to the medical care that they need, And while we always want people to plan ahead for disaster to strike, that's not always the case due to income requirement or income limitations or other expenses that families are facing. So I just want to say thank you for bringing the bill forward.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have worked not directly in the insurance business recently, but have had quite a bit of experience in training a lot of the licensed agents here in the state. And one of the very first things we teach folks in page one, chapter one of course one for insurance is something called adverse selection. And adverse selection is very simply this: those who need insurance tend to be the ones who want to buy insurance. Insurance is something that you buy because you anticipate that you're going to have a need, not, to use the term that we're using today, your house is already on fire when you're picking up the phone to call the agent. Things that I have concerns about is we don't know how this is going to affect the premiums overall. So when you pull out the stops like we did with Obamacare, when you pull out some of the other stops in here, we saw insurance prices run rampant, and we ended up having a lot of Minnesotans and a lot of folks who were concerned about their premiums. Could they continue to afford insurance? And we ended up bringing in a program in the individual market to help stabilize that called reinsurance. And I'm wondering if we're going to be finding ourselves kind of, if you will, with the Gray Panthers in a situation where they are going to need a reinsurance program for a Medicap program because premiums are going to get off the end, and we're going to have folks who are not going to be eligible for be eligible but not be able to afford the coverage. So I'm just laying out what I see past history telling us, knowing how the industry works, knowing how actuarial evaluation and review works on these things. There has to be, at some point, the bills getting paid, and those bills get paid by people paying premiums. And if bills go up, so do premiums go up for all participants in those particular plans, classes, or sets. And so, again, I have some concerns about what the financial ramifications are. And those financial ramifications are going to turn into affordability and access purely by finance to these policies, where some of the folks who were trying to benefit from this may not be able to afford it because of the increased cost in premiums, because of the increased risk in dollars that companies are going to end up having to pay. Not saying we shouldn't look at it, but those are my concerns here today. But past history has taught us. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'll give the final word to Representative Liebling.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Chair, before we do final word, Mr. Bacon pointed out to me a one-letter mistake in the bill. If we could do an oral amendment on 7.15, it says guarantee issue period, and it probably should say guaranteed.
I'm sorry, can you point out? What,
on line 7.15 of the DE1. And it says guarantee issue period, and it probably should say guaranteed. If we could just, if I could just move to insert the D,
I would entertain that motion. So Representative Liebling is moving to add the letter D to the word guarantee, or to strike the word guarantee, replace it with the word guaranteed, on line 7.15 of the DE1 amendment. Any discussion to that motion?
Mr. Chair, yeah, Mr. Chair, just give me a second, because there's other references in the bill to that. I just want to see if they tie together here. Just give me a moment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Driscoll. Any further discussion? Seeing none, Ms. Pompu, would you state for the record the oral amendment?
Surely. Chair and members. My mic on? Surely. Chair and members. Page 7, line 15, delete guarantee and insert guaranteed.
All in favor of the oral amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails and the oral amendment is adopted.
All right, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And so finally, I just would like to say that Representative New Brindley was saying that everyone can get covered. And that is in fact not really true, because even right now, We have, as I mentioned at the outset, at the beginning, when if you buy one of these plans, you have this, there's this exclusion where if you had either a diagnosis or treatment for a condition within 90 days, you can be excluded for that condition. So Representative New Brindley, you were very, very fortunate that ALS was not considered excluded, or you would have been, your family would have been in a world of hurt. I think we don't want our Minnesota families to be in a world of hurt. Our Minnesota seniors deserve to be able to buy coverage that actually protects them. A lot of states are doing this, and it just seems like Minnesota should be leading in this and not following and not leading our, leaving our elderly citizens without coverage that they need and deserve. So, members, I ask you to please support the bill. Thank you.
Representative Liebling renews her motion that House File 1790 as amended be recommended to be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and House File 1790 as amended is recommended to be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Thank you, Representative Liebling. Our final bill on our agenda today is House File 1726 from Representative Wolgamott. As Representative Wolgamott comes down, I will move House File 1726 be recommended to be placed on the general register. Representative Wolgamott, make yourself comfortable, and then to your bill.
Well, thank you very much, Chair Stevenson and Lead O'Driscoll and members of the committee for the opportunity to come before you this afternoon to present House File 1726. Mr. Chair and members, I'm bringing this legislation before you today because of the number one concern that I've been hearing about from my constituents in St. Cloud, concern over rising costs and inflation, particularly the rising costs of gas prices. Well, I've heard about this in conversations at the doors, at the grocery stores, in the mail, on TV. This is a huge topic, a huge issue for Minnesota families. And I know that members of this committee on both sides of the aisle have committed their willingness to do something to lower the price of gas for Minnesotans. Now, much of what drives gas prices is outside of the control of the state legislature. But, Mr. Chair, members, there is a law on the books that research shows keeps the price of gas artificially high here in Minnesota. That's right, you heard it. A current Minnesota law requires that gas retailers charge an 8-cent markup per gallon of gas. This is called the minimum markup. Selling below this 8-cent markup is against the law and could subject the gas station owner to civil and criminal penalties. So that's why I'm bringing House File 1726 before you this afternoon. What the bill does is it repeals the statute which makes any below-cost sale of gas an automatic violation, regardless of intent or effective sale. And it removes the definition of below-cost sale of gas as wholesale price being more than 8 cents or 6%, the lesser of those two, per gallon. So really what this is going to do is it's going to get gas to be in line with the same cost definition as any other good or service that we sell here in the state of Minnesota. Now, Mr. Chair and members, proponents of the existing minimum markup law will say that this law prevents competitors from undercutting the market and driving competition out through low gas prices. Proponents continue that this law protects smaller gas stations against the larger retailers. However, Mr. Chair and members, this is not a compelling argument based on economic research on this topic and a clear reading of Minnesota state and our federal law. A robust academic literature states that the main outcome of minimum markup laws is higher gas prices for consumers. And in addition, the Federal Trade Commission has reviewed minimum markup laws on gas sales and has stated these laws inhibit competitive pricing strategies and benefit consumers. I also want to be clear that predatory pricing below cost is already against the law and will remain so if this bill passes. And predatory pricing that damages competition is also against federal law. Also want to give some kind of statewide, nationwide context on this legislation. The vast majority of states do not have a minimum markup law on gas sales, and antitrust regulators do not see predatory pricing behavior in those markets on gas sales. As I mentioned, Mr. Chair, this is a bipartisan idea and bill. Scott Jensen, the Minnesota Republican nominee for governor, proposed eliminating this law during his gubernatorial campaign.
And in addition, Governor Evers of Wisconsin has also proposed limiting their minimum markup laws on gas to save consumers money at the pump. Mr. Chair, members, Minnesota's consumer laws should protect consumers, not harm them. By repealing Minnesota's minimum markup law, we will help consumers realize lower gas prices while still maintaining the protections against predatory pricing that harms competition. That's what this bill is about. That's why I'm bringing this bill forward. And with that, Mr. Chair, there are some testifiers who would care to provide further insight to you and the members of this committee as you consider your motion.
Thank you, Representative Wolgamott. We do have some testifiers, the first of which is Megan Forbes. Please come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Megan Forbes. I'm Senior Legislative Counsel at the Institute for Justice. The Institute for Justice is a nonprofit public interest law firm that works to protect civil liberties, including economic liberty. We've represented entrepreneurs and small businesses across the country challenging the constitutionality of protectionist laws, including an entrepreneur who is a gas station owner in Wisconsin challenging a law just like this. We support this bill because it will lift an anti-competitive law that serves no purpose but to protect special interests at the consumer's expense. The research is clear. Minimum markup laws on gas may have been enacted with the best of intentions in mind, but they do not protect consumers and they do not protect the number of small gas stations in a state. In fact, when researchers have looked at states that have these laws versus states that don't, they have found no difference in the number of mom and pop gas stations. The only difference they found is that gas prices are higher in states that have minimum markup laws. The FTC also discourages minimum markup laws on gas. It's found that they protect individual competitors, not competition, and hurt consumers. And finally, as it's already been noted, this law is not needed to protect against predatory pricing. It's already illegal under state and federal antitrust law. We ask that the committee stand with Minnesota consumers and support this reform and families in the state who are struggling to make ends meet right now with inflation. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Tim Gross. Come forward, state your name for the record, proceed your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tim Gross. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. Our association represents the 400 fuel marketers and licensed fuel distributors across the state. We're made up of mostly small family, multi-generational family businesses and farm co-ops. That group operates and owns a majority of the 2,500 C-stores, truck stops, and a few refueling sites across Minnesota. And just a little added point, I was also a marketer for 26 years before this job, so I can very well speak for the small marketers that are out there. I hear today testify in firm opposition of House 1726. We have reached out to the author of the bill to discuss our concerns several times and look forward to meeting with him. A brief history of Section 325D trade constraints. Our industry, with its retail fuel sales, is unique and highly vulnerable to bad retail actors who sell below cost. The majority of our total retail sales revenues are based on one product, gasoline sales. A commodity product with most transparent pricing to the consumers that can easily be targeted with below cost selling for the purpose or with the effect of injuring a competitor or destroying competition. Another term to describe this type of below cost selling is called predatory pricing. These bad actors use predatory pricing as a business model to put small retail competition out of business. This can be done quickly, measured in months, not years. This protection offered by the state law at that time was not enough. Small retailers were being injured and put out of business. A better solution was needed. In 2001, Section 325D.71, unlawful gasoline sales, was added to Chapter 325D, championed by then Attorney General Mike Hatch, including partnerships with MPMA, MSSA, and bipartisan support of the legislature. They understood the value of protecting small fuel retailers and the importance of healthy and abundant competition. They shared their beliefs because, in the end, it guaranteed lower prices for Minnesota consumers. More competition equates to lower prices. Thanks to Section 325D.71, we have a very successful policy that has created a system that easily identifies these bad actors, verifies the claims, and quickly and efficiently stops anti-competitive monopolistic behavior in time before small fuel retailers are too severely injured and put out of business. We are so grateful for the Department of Commerce's hard work and diligence in enforcing this statute. And may I also say that as a fuel marketer, we were one of the cases that were saved back in 2000 when we experienced a large retailer entering the Hermantown Duluth market. Because of that experience, I can live and am very passionate about the belief that has saved our business. We did not recover for over 10 years after that episode until the Department of Commerce changed that behavior of below-cost selling. And I just want to point out finally that this 8 cents is not a markup after all costs. This is not a profit. This is not a gross margin percent we're talking about. The 8 cents is an addition, or the 6%, whatever is lesser, is based upon the average cost, terminal cost, a wholesale price to our retailers. Today, that 8 cents may have meant something different in 2000, 2001. That 8 cents today represents just the cost of the freight to get that product in the ground to us. That doesn't pay for 1 cent of operating expense. This is the lowest level standard that we're asking to be saying. If you cross that line, you're in violation. And just finally to say, as a small retailer, if we had used the current law that was back in the 90s to try to save our business, our attorney on staff in our small town would have had to gone against a staff of 100 attorneys, and we would have been long out of business before we could ever proven the problem in case and issues of predator pricing that we are facing. So this is not fair. This is not a make-believe story. We live this on an everyday basis, and that's why this law became about. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Next, we have Lance Klatt. Sorry. Please come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lance Klatt, Executive Director of the Minnesota Service Station and Community Store Association, representing nearly 300 small independent fueling stations and auto repair owners, asking this committee to oppose House File 1726. Many of my small independent members are second, third generation family owners, been supporting Minnesota's economy and their local communities for nearly 60 years, including champions of biofuels and EV charging stations. Statute 325D.71, unlawful gasoline sales, has allowed many of my small owner operators to compete in an ever-changing yet aggressive marketplace. And a letter drafted by Institute of Justice sent to this committee stated there is no causal relationship between minimum markup laws and the number of small businesses. My state association is proof of that today. All my members are independent owners and not one large corporation in my organization. The letter stated cost prohibition statutes are routinely found to be unconstitutional. Back in 2007, Minnesota Court of Appeals found Minnesota Statute 325D.71 was constitutional in the case of Minnesota Department of Commerce versus Midwest Oil of Minnesota, LLC. Minnesota's below cost minimum markup on gas statute doesn't guarantee a fueling site a profit. The statute protects small business from predatory pricing and creating competition. I've created a handout today. Everyone should have a copy of that in front of them. Sorry for the small print there. I apologize for that. An analysis comprising of all 50 states. In this matrix, I have included gas prices from AAA from the date of June 27th of last year and currently as of February 17th of last week of this year. Currently, 44 states in the U.S. do not have below cost of sales gasoline statutes, or also I have not yet confirmed through all the industry associates I have that there may be more states that do.
I know back in 2006-ish, I think there was 13 states. I have broken down the averages of those 44 states, identifying the average retail and average state excise taxes. I have done the same for the six states highlighted in yellow below with below cost minimum markup gasoline statutes. The states with the below cost statutes average lower gasoline retailers of 18 cents on June 27th of last year and average 16 cents a gallon lower than those that do not have minimum markup laws on February 17th of last week. Also note the state gas tax averages about six and a half cents a gallon higher in the states with below cost statutes such as Minnesota. In conclusion, this statute was designed to curb the worst excesses without guaranteeing a profit. This statute allows both occasional sales below cost to meet a lawful price and coupon exemptions to the below cost pricing formula. The statute has worked well and has helped Minnesota retain independent, locally owned and operated businesses throughout Minnesota. Again, I ask you for your consideration to oppose House File 1726, protecting the integrity of lower gas prices in Minnesota and supporting my small fueling members. Thank you again for this opportunity to testify this afternoon.
Thank you. And next we have Martha Njolomele. I'm so sorry. Please come forward. State your name for the record. Accept my apologies for my mispronunciation. And proceed to testimony.
I'm used to that, so no problem.
It still doesn't make it right. I'm sorry.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Martha Njolomele. I am an economist at the Center of the American Experiment. I'm not sure if any of you are familiar with the organization. We are a conservative think tank based in Golden Valley. So much like previous testifier, Megan Forbes, I am in favor of Bill 726 because I believe it would enhance competition and possibly lower gas prices for Minnesotans. So we've heard a lot about this claim that big businesses, just want to take small businesses out. So the way that they do this is by lowering their prices so that small businesses can compete. But like Megan has said, there's no evidence that this is actually true. In fact, Cato said that there do not appear to be fewer businesses in states that do not have minimum price laws, something one would expect to see if cutthroat competition residing in the loss of small businesses were in fact a real-world problem. The fact of the matter is predatory pricing doesn't work. The reason that this is the case is because when one business goes out of the market, another one enters. And in the gas industry, the infrastructure is there. It doesn't go out because one gas station goes out of the market. Another one comes in and replaces that market. So the only way that predatory pricing would work is if one business could prevent other business from entering the market, which is very difficult, if not impossible. When sellers come here purporting that minimum markups protect customers, they only be hiding behind an imaginary problem just to protect themselves from the competition through such laws. A good example here is what happened in Wisconsin in 2015. So the retail chain store Meijer opened a couple of stores there, and apparently they were selling a couple of their products below cost, and they had about 37 complaints, not from customers but from their rivals, that they were undercutting them. End result, the Department of Agriculture ended up forcing them to raise their prices, which raised prices for consumers. The truth of the matter is that in a free market, sellers lower their prices for a number of reasons. They might want to get rid of excess inventory, or they want to attract repeat customers. For gas stations especially, they make most of their profits through selling items in their convenience store. So they do have an extra incentive to keep their prices low. But this law that we have on the books prevents them from doing just that, which then raises prices for low and middle income Minnesotans, hurting them even further. There's no reason that we should be making economic policy just to save businesses. So for that reason, I am in support of this law. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you. That was the last sign-up. Do we have any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion and questions. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Wolgamott, for this opportunity to have a really geeky discussion about antitrust theory. This bill really gets at one of the key, I think, long-standing debates in antitrust law and antitrust theory about sort of the older view of antitrust law, I think advocated very strongly by the senior senator from Minnesota, about antitrust law really being about protecting competitors and having as many small businesses, small competitors out in the marketplace as possible, versus kind of the Chicago school about that antitrust law should be about consumers and predatory pricing is right at the heart of that discussion about whether it's ever really possible for a company, for a monopolist or large companies to drive smaller competitors out and then recapture monopoly profits. And really at the heart of that is about what barriers there are of entry for someone to come back into the marketplace. And this is, one of the big big criticism of the Chicago school folks of sort of the older view of antitrust law is that once a monopolist or a bigger player starts to try to get monopoly profits, then other folks will come back in. And I guess what I'm concerned about in this context is whether those barriers of entry are present and maybe even increasing with environmental regulations and things like that that are being placed on gas station owners. And in particular, I noticed this was a Mr. Brannon, whose letter we were given, but he wasn't here. His testimony said on the bottom of the second page, the reality is that the decline in the number of stations that were driven by environmental laws that required older stations to replace their gas tanks and lines, as well as new economics that favored larger operations that could support a bigger retail operation. And so I guess what I'm interested in hearing a little bit more explanation of, I heard, you referenced a bunch of data and research. I'm curious as to help us to understand why we shouldn't be concerned about the barriers to entry, especially that are increasing for folks to get into the back into the retail gasoline sale business if larger operations are able to undercut them on price and drive them out of the business.
Representative Oldman.
Well, thank you very much, Chair Stevenson, and thank you for the question, Representative Niska. So first of all, the scenario that you're describing where large companies come in and they drive down their prices and they drive people out, that's already illegal under state law and under federal law. Now, I'd be more happy to work with you on maybe take a look at strengthening those laws through different legislation or putting some more teeth on those. That's definitely something that I would really welcome the opportunity to work with you on. As far as the barriers to entry, I wouldn't refute what you read from that letter from, I think you said it was from a Mr. Brannon. Those kind of environmental regulations are outside of the scope of this particular bill. Again, would be more than willing to take a look at that with you and maybe put some legislation together on that. But what we've seen in other states is that antitrust regulators are not seeing predatory pricing behavior in the markets of the states that don't have minimum markup laws. So this really, it goes back to the point that this is this law is a solution in search of a problem that doesn't exist, but it does cause a problem in contributing to the cost of living here in Minnesota, contributing to high gas prices. So as far as those environmental regulations, it could be potential barriers. That's outside the scope of this legislation. More than happy to work with you on taking a look at that through other legislation. Also would welcome the opportunity to, add some more teeth to our laws that are that make it illegal to do that type of predatory pricing that you described. Representative Niska, thank you.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Wolgamott. I appreciate the direction this legislation is going in. I guess I'm still unconvinced about a couple of things. One is, like I said, this does seem like the type of industry where predatory pricing maybe should be a particular area of concern. And as you correctly pointed out, there still is general antitrust law in place that might provide for enforcement of predatory pricing. This seems like a fairly modest kind of prophylactic or yardstick way for us to potentially deal with this problem. We should maybe call him Dr. Brandon. His testimony referencing Wisconsin indicated they had a higher minimum markup law than what we have in Minnesota. So, I appreciate the ability for you to bring forward this antitrust issue in a way that I think shows some independence from some other voices in your party, especially. But I'm not yet 100% convinced that this is the right direction to go in this particular market. I appreciate the discussion.
Further discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wolgamott, you and I both represent a substantial part of central Minnesota. And just for the record, since we're seeing what we're hearing from people, I'm hearing a lot of people who want Social Security tax relief from the part of the district that I represent. But I will stay to the topic of the bill here today, which is removing minimum pricing and fuel here in the state of Minnesota. I would be willing to bet that most people in this room know that there are ways that the larger players in the marketplace, larger retailers, and the like, have ways of getting around the current law as it stands. Anybody who's a card-carrying member of Costco, Sam's Club, Walmart, just to name a few, they're working around this because they're membership organizations, and as a benefit of membership, they're lowering their fuel prices. Where Representative Wolgamott and I live, there's a program that's being run in conjunction with a grocery store called More Rewards. And when you go in, you purchase groceries, you get cents off cumulative on your gas price when you go to the pump. When I go up to where Representative Andrew Brindley lives, theirs is with Cub Foods for the retailers that are up there. Down in this area, same thing with the Cub retailers. So there are already many ways that the large players are able to partner through membership to lower their gas prices. Taking this law out of the books, Representative Wolgamott, what does it do to the small retailer who doesn't have the ability to be able to participate in those larger organizations? What's their future viability? And I'm asking that in a very sincere way, because you're the one who's bringing this forward, and they're still able to exist right now in that stiff wind competition that they're seeing. But removing this, what does it do for them? Does it open up an advantage to some of the larger retail establishments that are out there? Or does it just say, now we have a fair playing field with the large retailers and what they can do, and the small retailers?
Representative Wolgamott.
Well, thank you, Chair Stevenson, and thank you for the thoughtful question, Representative O'Driscoll. Based on taking a look at the vast majority of the states in the United States do not have a minimum markup law on gas, and there have been many studies put forward by academic institutions, by nonpartisan economists at the Federal Trade Commission, that show that there is no correlation between states that do have minimum markup laws, states that don't have minimum markup laws, and the number of small gas retailers in those states. So based on what we're seeing in the other states that do not have a minimum markup law, there is little impact on these small gas retailers and their futures.
You know, Representative Driscoll, before I give it back to you, your question made me wonder. So if I'm a small retailer in central Minnesota and I want to lower my prices to compete with Costco in order to get people to come to my store to go inside and buy things inside where maybe I make more money, I can't do that under this existing law. Isn't there some benefit to the small retailer for being able, if they want to compete with other people and lower their prices? To your point, a large membership organization already can do that, and a small retailer can't. Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because it actually begs a bigger question, Mr. Chair, and that is that a lot of these players who are in these markets are contracting with a particular franchise or a particular retailer, And a lot of that carnage has already taken place with those smaller retailers that have closed. You can drive around central Minnesota and you can see where there was a filling station or a gas station or a convenience store that still actually has the label, the sign on the building with the pumps out in front. But they're no longer in business because they just can't compete in the marketplace. So I think that we're already seeing some of what you're talking about, Mr. Chair, and the carnage is there. You just need to drive around and take a look at it.
Before I give you the final word, Representative Wolgamott, I just wonder, I did want to ask you, and I'm sorry I didn't tell you in advance I was going to ask this question. What other minimum markups exist under Minnesota law? What are the products? This is not a trick question. I'm not aware of any. I'm asking you.
Gas is the only product that we have this for. There are no other products in the state that have minimum markups on them.
So I was just thinking about other, you know, another dark-colored liquid that I find essential to life, of coffee, for example. No minimum markup for coffee.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Right. So, but somehow we find that small independent coffee shops are able to continue to exist even without that benefit. Or I was just making a list here of all the things where you have large national chains that could undercut the prices. So like cheeseburgers, no minimum markup for cheeseburgers, right?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. But somehow there are, I think, small mom and pop restaurants that manage to survive without that particular protection, I guess. Anyway, that's just my observation. Representative Wolgamott, I will give you the final word.
Well, thank you, Chair Stevenson and Lito Driscoll and members of the committee for the opportunity to present this legislation and for the thoughtful discussion. As you consider the motion before you, I want you to ask, how do our constituents benefit from a law that keeps prices artificially high while doing nothing to increase competition? Mr. Chair and members, let's take action. Let's do something that will lower the price of gas. Let's do something that will get more money back into the pockets of Minnesotans to our constituents. And I ask for you to support the motion to send House File 1726 to the General Register. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members.
All right. I will renew my motion that House File 1726 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. The motion prevails, and House File 1726 is recommended to be placed on the General Register. Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, just so you can sleep better tonight, milk also does, by the way, have a minimum price that is in the marketplace.
Milk.
Minimum markup.
Milk.
And I would also just remind you that at one point in time, your cheeseburger example, but a member of the legislature was still here who has a cheeseburger bill, and if that comes back, it's because you brought it and put it out there today. Just saying, Mr. Chair.
Noted. No further agenda. No items on the agenda. The meeting is adjourned.